And I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to speak. It's always an honor. This is a beautiful place. It's my first time up here, and they're already making plans to come back next year. And I heard a couple of the people saying today how hard it is to talk on a topic. And when I asked them, okay, do I have a topic at the women's draft? They're like, no, just do whatever you want. Like, so do I do my whole lead? How much time? Like, just do whatever you want. I'm like, all right, now this is hard. So, you know, whenever, you know, the half hour or whatever to speak, I try to tunnel my lead to, like, you know, just kind of tone it down a little bit to the important parts. And I've been clean since January 20th of 1987. I'm an addict. There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. I've been coming steady for 29 years, and they talked about the third tradition today and talked about the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop using. And I can guarantee you, if it wasn't for that tradition, I might not have showed up here. I might not have stayed, because I showed up and there were a lot of things I haven't done. I was 21 years old when I got clean. And, you know, I had a lot of stuff left in me that was yet to be done, but I hadn't, that wasn't my path, you know. There are a lot of things I couldn't relate to what people were talking about as far as using or jails or institutions or, you know, robbing grandma. It just wasn't my story. And that kept me out of rooms for a little bit because I came around as a support girlfriend, you know. I'm here for him. I'm going to help him, you know. And I looked at all the differences at that time. And that's what kept me away from it. That's what kept me separate. But when the time came, because I had a little bit of exposure to the, you know, to the fellowship. And, you know, that's the beauty of it. If anybody's here today and this is your first time here, it's over. I'm sorry to tell you. It'll just never be the same because now you know that there's an alternative, you know. There's an alternative way of life that you can choose to have if you choose to have it. Because we're here to help you. And that's what happened to me when I walked into the room. My first meeting was an AA meeting. And then I got involved in the East End in the Greenfield area and put together a lot of, you know, helped put together a lot of meetings. Let me get out of some because it's hard. You want to move that thing? I don't know. But anyway, so that tradition got me in here and it kept me in here. Because I tried to quit using, and no matter what I was doing, no matter what I wasn't doing, I couldn't stay clean. I would try to switch things up or do things different. Or not go to this bar, or not hang with these people, or not drink this liquor, or not do this drug. I just tried everything. And I just couldn't stay clean. And I wanted to stay clean. I didn't want to live the life I was living anymore. And I'm going to talk about that desire. I had the desire to stay clean, but I just kept looking at all the differences. And so I came in here and spent a very short stint in AA, and then we start putting some meetings together in the East End because, you know, our meeting list back when I got clean was, it was like an IP. It was three pages, you know, the trifold IP. That's how big the meeting list was. So there was lots and lots of opportunity to get involved and, you know, put some meetings together. And that's what me and my boyfriend did at the time. So I get in here, and I'm in. I mean, I jumped in both feet because I was 21. Most of my girlfriends were still using. My sister was using. I had to make some new friends. I really didn't know what else to do. I knew all about people's places and things. I had this gift. I don't know what it was. I believed everything the people told me. I just did. I did what I was told to do. I got a home group. I got involved. I stayed away from people, places, and things. I showed up at meetings. I got a sponsor. I mean, I came in here and I went all in because there was really no alternative. What else was I going to do? I wasn't real crazy about being young. I came in with a boyfriend. You know, they say don't get into a relationship. I can understand that. I was in one 6 years already. I wasn't getting out. He was clean. He got clean in October. I realized at that point in time I wasn't ready to get clean. I was on my own for a few months. Then January of 87, he was October 86. I was January 87. So I understand why they say don't get into a relationship, because I had a really good way of keeping the focus off myself. You know, either it could have been about what you were using and how were you using and what you were doing and to get ways and means to get more, or it went to, you should call your sponsor. What step were you on? You know, so I get that. You know, so I come in, I get involved, I'm picking up service commitments, I'm doing H&I. I understand why they talk about having some step work under your belt for H&I, having maybe a little bit of time working with a sponsor. Because I found out what H&I did for me at different points in my recovery. It looked good on the outside. I was able to hide behind H&I. I was able to do, help others, but not really work on the inside. But hey, look what I'm doing. I got like two H&I commitments. You know, some girl asked me to be her sponsor a few years ago, and I asked her what steps she was on. She was sitting on her four. She had four H&I commitments. I said, you need to drop three of those and do your four steps. Oh, what are you talking about? You know, but you know, H&I is great, but it's also a really good place to hide. You know, for me it was. And so I bought in. You know, I got a sponsor, my first sponsor. I love her dearly, so I think she's using now, but you know, she did the best for me at the time. And she was a woman who dated a guy from Greenfield. And I was from Greenfield, and my boyfriend was from Greenfield. And you know, I got in and I put down the drugs, but I still had an anger problem and I still had a control problem. And you know, I didn't do real good work in my steps for too long, you know, because I thought being clean was enough. Really, I did. I got the first step. I understood that I was powerless and that I couldn't use anymore. Dennis was talking about doing 1 and 12. You know, I could help anybody. I would help you. I would take you to a meeting. I would do whatever I could do. But, you know, it took me. I was a slow learner. And it caused me a lot of, it was a painful process, unfortunately. But the beauty of it is, you know, you don't usually get to the other side. And that's when I was thinking of a topic to him. Like, oh, yeah, getting to the other side. That could be a good topic for my story, you know. And, you know, I got in and I always wasn't working on the solution. I was working on a lot about trying to change my boyfriend, basically, to be honest. A lot of comparisons, you know. There's a thing about sticking with, you know, we talk about sticking with people when we're using. You always kind of want to stick with people who are maybe using worse than you and you don't think you're doing so bad. Because I like to do that when I was using, right? You can do it here too, you know. you can do it real easy here. You can hang out with some people who are, you know, staying clean and living dirty, and you might not be living dirty, but you might not be living to your full potential either. But it's real easy to get comfortable if you're like hanging with people who are staying clean and living dirty. Hey, shit, I'm doing good, you know. And I have learned I could always be better, you know. And the only thing that kind of stuff does for me is that just keeps me really sick. And so I got in here and I start working a little bit of steps. You know, my first four steps was about what I did, but what a kind of a bad person I was. It was kind of a surface four step. I didn't get real deep with my four steps. And I paid the price for that. You know, eventually I did another one, but I didn't get to the real root of my disease, you know. 3 years clean. My clean date is January 20th. I had my first child January 21st. After, you know, I showed up for my 3 years clean, and the guy said to me, you better not go through for it, that baby's coming, you know. And so January of 1990, I had my first child, and August of 1997, I had my fourth. So needless to say, I got clean, I got married, I had four children within 10 years. I guess if I got clean, yeah, 87 to 97, within 10 years. You know, my life started moving pretty fast, and I always went to meetings, I always had a home group. But there is something to be said about social acceptability, and I got really confused about recovery. I would show up at meetings, I would try to help some people, and I'm sure I helped them, you know. But I wasn't living to my full potential. I said it to my sponsee the other day, God gave me and my husband every possible tool you could possibly have. You know, the toolbox they talk about, we had it all out. It was all given to us. But if you don't use those tools, your house will fall down, you know. And getting clean and staying clean, believe me, it's the beginning and it's wonderful. But for me, as an addictive person with an addictive personality, I could be just as crazy and sick clean than I was using. And honestly, there are days where I think I had a lower bottom spiritually clean than I did when I was using, you know, because when there's nothing to cover it up, pain is intense, you know, it got really, really intense. I quit using the sponsor probably around step 6 or 7, probably around year 4 or 5, you know, not a good idea. It's never a good idea not to use a sponsor. Never, ever, ever. Don't ever stop using a sponsor around 6 or 7. That's a doubly bad idea, you know. But, you know, I just started getting things confused. I was a good mother, you know. I took care of my children. I was very involved in their lives. You know, they had everything they needed. We put together a business. We had a really nice house. I mean, they were well taken care of. There were a lot of things on the outside that I was supposed to be doing anyway, you know. Supposed to take care of my children. I'm supposed to take care of my house. So I would get really confused thinking, oh, I'm doing good because I'm doing all this other stuff, you know. But on the inside, I really wasn't doing good. I was a pretty angry person, you know. And I saved it for special people, you know. That was close to me, you know. They got it. And, you know, my kid said to me, you know, a few years ago after I went through this really big thing, I'll eventually tell you about. They said to me, you never look happy. And it was like, oh, you know, like gut-wrenching pain. Mm-hmm. Like, and it was like, Mom, you never look happy. And I think, what a waste of recovery that was, you know? What a waste of recovery that I can look back on that and say that God had given me everything that I needed to have a happy and joyous free. Like, not that it was all bad, it could have just been so much better. Problems might have been resolved if the tools were being used. You know what I mean? I talk about self-sufficiency versus God's sufficiency. I was the most self-sufficient person. I got it. God was my co-pilot. I'll let you know if I need some help. Because I believed in God. I was raised Catholic, and I'm not going to bash the Catholics, but I had no relationship with God. You know? I said my third step prayer, but when I was saying my third step prayer, life was good. You know? I didn't come in here struggling and dying and, you know, out of jail or on paper or, you know, the judge on my back. I came in here, I stood up at that first AA meeting, I said, I'm Patty, I'm an alcoholic, I sat down and I've been clean since. But I got involved. So, but when I got to that third step prayer, I was like, okay, I can turn my will and my life over to care of God. I was like, sure, no problem, you know, life's good, it's easy, you know. I had to learn that that same God was the same God, even when things were bad. It was the same God. God didn't move away, I moved away. Mm-hmm. I had to realize that kind and loving God who brought me to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous was the same disciplined God that had to show me that I needed Him more than He needed me. You know, I was brought to my knees spiritually around year 10. And I was angry. Things were going on in my house. My husband was doing his thing. We were clean. It's all about being clean, you know. There was a lot of disease. There wasn't a whole bunch of God in my house. There was a lot of control. There was a lot of fight for control in my house. There were a lot of good things, too. I don't want to make it sound bad, but, you know, the lessons I learned from the life that I led, when Julie and I were coming up here, it was like two different lives, wasn't it? I'm like, yeah, it was. And if I could give anybody any message of hope, and like the complacency that can happen around here is devastating. It's so devastating. Those character defects that you thought, well, I never tell any of my sponsees that went away. They go away. They're dormant. They're dormant. As soon as the light shines on them again, they grow at intense rates, and they just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I believe character defects really grow on somebody who's been clean for a while and thinks they know something, you know? So that's what happened. And so we're clean, we're trying to do what we're trying to do, and they went well for a while. But then, you know, around year 10, I knew something was up. I don't know if any of you had these moments of clarity maybe where you're thinking, I'm being an asshole, you know. You might want to take a look at your anger problem you got going on here, you know. I don't know if any of you have had those moments of clarity, but I had one up here, somewhere around here. We were up here with the family, and it was not a good weekend. And I remember thinking to myself, you need to do something. You need to do something, and you need to do something now. And because I knew it was about me. You know, the problem with self-awareness and coming around here long enough, the denial eventually, it's, you just can't deny it anymore, you know. So I knew I needed something. I know I needed a sponsor again. I know I needed to get back into work in some steps. And I knew I needed to start trying to look more at myself than at him. But it was hard. It was hard. It was extremely, extremely hard, because when somebody's living a certain lifestyle and you're clean and it's affecting your family, it's not real easy to walk away. I'll tell you what I wish I would have done. I wish I would have went to like a family like an Al-Anon or an Aranon. I wish I would have did that 15 years ago, you know? Because I did that at the end. And the benefit I got from that, I'm like, damn, I showed up late. And they're like, no, you showed up when you were ready. And but there was a lot of stuff I understood about powerlessness over my addiction. I understood that I couldn't use one day at a time. I could not get powerlessness over somebody else. And I'm not even talking about somebody using, I'm just talking about somebody's behaviors or somebody's decisions or somebody's whatever, you know. It was the power of the forces in my house. There were like two magnets that just like, you know, just kept, could not come together on things. And my solution to try to force change is my anger. And it didn't work very well, you know. We had a very successful business. We raised four kids. Things went really well for us. You know, money, property, prestige, they talk about that in the tradition, how it can divert our group from its primary purpose, and then also talks about in that tradition how it can hit us personally, and then hit my family personally. We were blessed with a lot of outside things, and we lost everything that we had. Everything that we had was taken away from us, from poor financial decisions, bad business markets. My husband started gambling when the financial stuff started, you know, to try to compensate for some of the other financial loss, because we were living way beyond our means. The humility to live within your means. I say it now, if you would have ever told me that I would be okay on my job and my income, because my job was always a second job, you know. You would have told me 20 years ago that I was going to be financially secure in my job, I'd be like, yeah, right, you know. But I live within my means today. It's like such a concept, you know. It's such a freaking concept. Do not spend more than you make and you will be fine. Right? I don't know. We didn't get it. We had so much credit and so much crap and so much stuff that I was never financially secure. We probably had 4 times or 5 times more of the money that I make today. And we were sweating bullets every Friday, you know, because we were self-employed and had to pay people and pay bills and pretty. So, needless to say, he started gambling. And I'm going to tell you something about gambling. I know this is an NA meeting, but I'm going to tell you something about other addictions. It was the beginning of the ruin of my family, because it took such a grip of my husband that he came home one day and threw $14,000 on the bed, like, look what I won. And I looked at him and said, you're the biggest asshole I've ever met in my life. He's like, only you would be mad that somebody won 14 grand. Because I knew it wasn't over. It wasn't over. And I don't know what it took to get that 14 grand, but I knew once you win 14 grand, it's over. You know? And it was. It was over. But the gambling addiction really took over. And that gambling addiction made me nuts. I mean, any anger or anything that I had, it was like tenfold by then. It was tenfold by then. He had knee surgery, and he had to start taking prescription medication for his knee surgery. He had an artificial limb. He was having knee surgery. And I got drug addiction because he wasn't taking it properly. And I got someone gambling in my house. I always, here's my analogy. He was caught up in the physical aspect of it. I was caught up in the spiritual, emotional aspect of it. We lost everything that we had for various reasons. Gambling didn't help, but there were other factors to that. I went from belonging to a swim and golf club to not being able to afford prom dresses for my children. And that is no exaggeration. We lost our home. We lost all our material stuff. He was still using, and we had to move. And we moved up to the South Hills. And my family waited a little bit before they decided to help us out, because they weren't helping right away, because they were like, you're making bad decisions, you know. And they helped us get a house you know, went in somebody else's name. They weren't trusting us with anything. 20 years. We got 20 years. And people are like, nah, we'll put the name in. We'll put the house in our name. We're good, you know. And it just wouldn't stop, you know. He wouldn't quit gambling. He wouldn't quit using. And by this point, I was really not well. I was spiritually at a bottom. I hadn't felt like using. I never really felt like using. Didn't feel like killing myself. And then none of that like drastic stuff. But I was pretty much at a spiritual bottom. And I remember when we were moving. We didn't know where we were moving. We were renting. Are we buying? What can we afford? What can't we afford? And I remember thinking to myself, you have a fellowship. You have your friends and you have Narcotics Anonymous. You cannot use. Like, using just wasn't an option. You know, I just know today, like, using is not an option for me. And so I got back in. Like, I was in. Okay, I was in. I was, like, in. You know? I got in. And let me tell you, when I got in, it was like, I'm going to be all right, you know? And I went to meetings 21, 22 years playing ball with my eyes out, totally humiliated, embarrassed. I picked up more sponsees from that point on than I ever had in my life. You know, my entire recovery from that minute that I decided, like, this is what I need to do to take care of myself. Sponsees, like, they were coming out of the woodwork. And every time I turned around, somebody was asking me to sponsor. It saved my ass. It saved my ass. It got me the meetings. It kept me accountable. Kept me in the literature. You know, my husband's still doing what he's doing. We moved to the South Hills in June of 2009. By February 2010, he gotta go. He just gotta go. That fall of 2009, I woke up and I remember thinking to myself, I can't do this anymore. I cannot. I can down on. And I'll say, and I don't know. Call me tradition, by the way, or I don't really care. I didn't cause it. And cure it, you know. There's another C that's in there. Causing it and cure it. I did not cause him to use. I cannot cure him. I tried everything in my power. Everything from verbal threats and letting him in to doing this to doing like whatever. Whatever I could possibly do to try to get him to quit using, he just wouldn't quit. And then the fall of 2009, I'm like, I'm done. I just can't do it anymore. The whole family, because we had a pretty strong family. My kids were raised in a clean household. They were born into a mother and father who were clean, you know. The devastation that it took on them, like, they were starting to, like waver a little bit. They're like, what the hell is going on here? You know, like, they knew Dad wasn't right, and they knew I never looked happy, okay? You know, it was just that moment of clarity when my feet hit that floor that October in 2009. I'm like, I'm done. Can't do it. If he's not going to do something different, I can't do anything. I can't do this anymore. And by February 2010, he was out. He was out on the PFA, and then by June of 2011, he was out for good, and he never came back, you know. He died April 2012, you know. He never quit using. Things got worse. You know, I put him out in 2010 thinking, he had 20 years, 21 years. He knows all kinds of people. He would help everybody, and again, help everybody out here. You know, tell everybody else how to work their program. And I'll take his inventory, because I would tell him about it. Because I was doing the same thing. But in here, not doing the inside work, you know. And so I put him out in 2010, and I thought, we'll see what happens. It got worse. It got so bad. There were days where I think about what actually happened to him and the degradation and the way he was living and how he was acting and the people he was hanging with. There were days where I think, what the happened to my life? Like, what happened here? You know? Never thought in a million years. When that shit hits close to home, you hear it happen to other people, you're like, oh, that's so sad. That's the disease. That's what happens to people. It is. It's the truth. That shit hits home, you're like, what the fuck? You know? Especially after 20 years of being clean. Like I said, we were given everything. The tools were there. Here, God said, here it is. I'm giving it all to you. And he took it back, you know, because we were totally self-willing our life. And so I waited a year, and I waited to see what happened, you know, with him. And it didn't get any better. and I needed to take care of myself. I needed to start making decisions for me and my family, for me and my children, because I didn't deserve, and they did not deserve, the consequences of his addiction. Probably one of the hardest things I ever had to do in my life, you know. Because when you put somebody out, and they get clean, you're like, yeah, I did the right thing, see that, you know. When you put somebody out and they die, whoa, it ain't so easy, you know. And that's when I showed up to Alan. I showed up to Alan probably 9 months before he died, you know, and that helped me. I don't know if I could, I don't know what I would have done without it. I might have been able to get it here, I don't know, but that's where I got it. And it really helped me a lot. It really got me through to the other side, because I was talking to Sherry today, and people will say to me, you know, you're so relaxed anymore. And I'm the happiest I've ever been. And sometimes I don't feel like, it took me a while to be like, to be okay with being okay. I'm allowed to be okay. Yeah, my family was devastated. Yeah, we went through a lot. Yeah, Paul died. Yeah, a lot of things happened. But when all that stuff was going on, like I said, I was back in. And I haven't left, you know. I was telling Julie on the way up here, you can have your spiritual awakening here. And you can lose it. Don't think just because you've been spiritually awake, your spirit can't be. You know those things they put over the candles? That happens, you know. But that's what happened to me. And what I had to do when all this stuff was coming down, I had to get back. I had to recalculate my life. First of all, I had to stay focused on my children. My children's stability was the most important thing to me when all this stuff was going down. Not just even after he died, but more even after he died. And after he died, I did what I needed to do to take care of myself. I changed up some home groups. I moved over in the Southfield by now. I got new home groups out there. I changed areas completely. I got home groups. I had sponsees. And I took care of myself. I went to work. I did what I was supposed to do. And I kept the focus on my children. I did not go out and try to fix myself with externals. Because I know that the externals are not the solution. So that whole first year, probably in 2 years, you know, that's all I did, to take care of myself. Because if I can't take care of myself, I can't take care of anybody. When they say put the thing on the plane, they're not lying, you know. Because if I'm stuck in air, everybody else is dying. You know, my kids were devastated. They were born into a father who loved them. I'm telling you, your kids will not keep you clean. If Paul's children could not keep you clean, could not keep him clean, I will guarantee you, those babies in that stroller will not keep you clean. My husband loved his family, he loved his children, but it didn't matter. It did not matter. So anyway, what I had to do for myself was I had to recover. I had to get back into the room. God was in charge now. God made it very clear to me that I had no idea what I was doing, you know. I remember sitting in my living room one night when all the kids were gone. I was by myself, and I had a spiritual awakening. And I felt the hand, the grace of God tell me, you need to step it up. This is not enough. You're not doing enough. And with my relationship with him, you know. And I needed to, like, relook at things and take an inventory and just really learn how to have a relationship with God through prayer and meditation. And that has saved my eyes. And that's why I'm so happy today. And that's why I look so relaxed, you know. I sold the house in the South Hill. Like, I just went over to the kind of back to where I grew up, Northeast, and I run my home. Everything worked out, you know. I sold my house. I made a little profit. I bought a new house. I got a couple dollars in the bank. Like, nothing major, but I don't even care, you know. But if you would have told me 8-9 years ago that this was going to be all right, when people say it's going to be all right, you're like, yeah, it's going to be all right. You know? I don't know how I'm buying groceries this week, but it's going to be all right, you know. But it was through discipline. I did not spend what I wasn't supposed to spend. I got a little thing on my credit karma, you know, that credit karma thing the other day. It was an Olympic themed thing. He said, "You're a true gymnast. You've got a grip on your credit." And I'm like, "I did." And that's because I did without. I did without. I shopped in resale. This is resale. This is resale. I still shop in them resale shops. Once you stop shopping in the resale shop, you just don't shop in there. Quit shopping there because they got pretty nice stuff, actually. But I humble myself. Let me tell you, I used to shop in Squirrel Hill. I don't have money to shop in Squirrel Hill. I'm not getting credit cards to shop in Squirrel Hill. I'm going to the resale shops. I got 3 pair of shorts for the summer. You know what I mean? Like, you make your payments. You do what you're supposed to do. And it just kept getting better and better and better. It's so good now somebody has to pinch me. My life is so at peace. I just sent my youngest off to college, you know. And I'm like, we're going to mom's. I got 2 older ones at home, but they're like roommates. I'm like, see ya. Going to mom's. They're like, all right, mom. I went to the rodeo like 2 weeks ago. Got home at midnight on a Tuesday. They're like, where were you? I'm like, at the rodeo. They're like, what? You know? So, you know, if I can give anybody, if you're struggling here, if things aren't going your way, you know, if you have somebody in your life that might, you're having a little bit of trouble being powerless over, you gotta help yourself. And that doesn't, I don't mean that in a mean way. I don't mean that you don't try to help them, but here's the way my whole family wasn't going down in the ship. There was a lifeboat, and he chose not to get into it. And I had to get in the lifeboat, you know? And that was probably the biggest thing I've had to have to work through. But it's okay, you know, it's okay today. And I'm very grateful for the room to Narcotics Anonymous and the women in these rooms. Because let me tell you, I'm not like a guy girl. Like, I like the guys, but I'm not a guy girl. You know, somebody asked me having a date, like, for the first time, like, 3 weeks ago. Fuck, here we go. Here we go. It's been 5 years I've been by myself. Why now? You know what I mean? So fucking uncomfortable. I just stick with the girls, you know what I mean? But, sorry, I don't know. We'll see. But anyway, I'm a girl's girl. There ain't no doubt about it because I get what I need from you women. The guys are great, but the women will kick your ass and the men will pat your ass. And I'm not a man hater. So don't get me wrong. I'm not a man hater by any means. But if you want to grow in this program, you better stick with the women, you know? And thanks. Thanks for being here.
All right. I'd like to introduce the second speaker, Amy B., from the Get Your Day Started group of NA in the Swana area of NA.
Hey, thank you. My name is Amy, and I am an addict.
Hi, Amy.
I want to thank the committee of this retreat for asking me to speak and share my experience, strength, and hope. I want to thank Patty. I got to meet Patty about 4 years ago through service work. It's real nice to see a smile on your face today. I remember some of those things you were going through, and you were so private, the little things that you shared, because it was just little. It's very private. And I agree. Funny, as she was beginning this thing, it was like, okay, give me a topic. Give me a topic. It's so much, for me, it's so much easier to speak on a topic. But now I got to talk about women, relationships with women. That's what, when it came to women's rap, and I was like, oh, the women's rap, yeah. Shoot, what am I going to say? And I prayed. I left the last meeting when it was over, and I walked, and I took a little time, and I did my little prayers, and I went back to where it was supposed to be. I'm like, this is not the crowd I expected. I'm like, but okay, let's find out what's going on. And I came down here, and they told me, you know, we were relocated here. So, my clean date is 3/20/08. I do realize I only have just for today, though. I realize that, you know, my time is my time, but I really truly only have just for today. Very similar to Patty, I came in, and when I came in, I jumped in feet first, got immersed in finding a home group, finding a sponsor, getting involved with service work. It's so wonderful to see the smiling face back there of the woman who taught me the true meaning of service work and getting involved and taking me to her house and sitting me down at the computer and teaching me how to be the secretary of an area. You know, because I knew how to take notes and I knew how to do all that, but how to put it in a way so that it could be explained to the next person what was said and what was done and what it was all about. And when I did that, I thought I knew a little bit of something. Like, because people would call me. They would say, what's going on in the area? And I could just pull out everything and know what was going on. I knew what was going on. I didn't know how to do a whole bunch of stuff, but I knew what was going on, and it kept me involved. So I kept showing up, and I kept showing up, and I keep showing up, and I keep showing up. And service work has truly been a blessing to me. It has kept me clean when I did not want to call my sponsor, when I did not want to do step work, when I did not want to answer my sponsor's phone calls. Service work has kept me clean. You know, as Patty was saying, being married to a recovering addict is not always the easiest thing in the world. I came into this program and I had just left a 22-year relationship. I was married for 19 and a half years when I came into this program, because I knew that if I did not leave that relationship, I would not stay clean. I knew if I stayed in that relationship, if I could stay clean, that I would kill. And I mean that literally and physically. See, I was in a 22-year relationship with a man who was mentally, physically, and emotionally abusive to me. And when I prayed all the time that God let that last hit be the one that takes me out, that puts me into a coma so that I don't have to wake up to this misery one more day. And when that didn't work, when God didn't answer that prayer, I began to put a needle in my arm. And I said, God, let this one be the last one. But don't let my children find me like this. Whatever you do, take me out. Take me out of this misery. But don't let my children find me like this. Because, see, I did get 4 blessings out of that relationship. And they're my children. 3 that I gave birth to, and 1 that I was given to when he was 12 years old. And he was my ex-husband's child, but he is my child because I raised him and I loved him as if I gave birth to him. You know, and I prayed, but God didn't part that sea that I wanted to walk through. You know, he had a different story. He had a different idea of what my life was to be. And I remember sitting at a traffic light. And I had $80 in my pocket, and it was payday. And that's all I had left from some of the bills that I had paid. And I sat there, and I said, I can turn up the hill, and I can go to my dealer's house, or I can go straight. And I went straight, and I picked up the phone. And on my way, driving to where my destination was going to be, I called Braddock Hospital. And they said, yeah, we take those for detox. I get there, and they tell me they don't detox my drug of choice. And I tell them, well, I have $80 in my pocket, and the amount I'm using and what I'm doing, I'm going to end up dead. And he said, hold on, you just may have saved your life. Mm-hmm. And he comes back. I have no idea how much longer. It seemed like almost a lifetime, but it wasn't that long. He came back and he said, you may have just saved your life by saying those words. We're going to put you on digital diagnosis. And I think, thank God I'm crazy. You know, so they admitted me under dual diagnosis because, see, cocaine is not addictive, so they think. You know, because I know for me that cocaine was very addictive. You know, and when they do that drug test on you, and they come up and they say, what have you been using? And I say, cocaine. And they're like, well, how come there's heroin, LSD, PCP, and all these other things? Because that's what they told me was in the bag. That's what I believed. Needless to find out, it didn't matter. I was an addict. I went into treatment. I went into an outpatient treatment facility to see this man that I was married to still at this time did not know that I was an addict. Well, he did not know that I was putting a needle in my arm because, see, I smoked weed every single day that I was with him, other than the days that I was in the hospital giving birth to my children. The whole time I was pregnant, all 3 children, I smoked weed. Part of those times, I put a needle in my arm with my first child. No, let me correct that. With the child I lost due to the fact of putting a needle in my arm. And then I quit for 17 years of putting a needle in my arm. And then I started again. I went to bed every night with him and never saw track marks. He was oblivious to what was going on. Thank God he was, because he might have beat me down. We had our own business. I had rental properties. I quit paying mortgages because I needed to get help. So the 5 properties we have, 1 foreclosed, the next foreclosed. I just kept lying as to why they were foreclosed. And, you know, oh, it was that, you get into those balloon mortgages. There was no balloon. I just didn't pay it. You know, I just didn't pay it. So, originally My first clean date is in January. I don't even remember what it was, but it was January that I took myself to Braddock Hospital. I went through an outpatient program. I thought I could make something happen. We thought we could rekindle this marriage that I knew was dead years before, but I just didn't have the strength to leave it. So I'm going to outpatient, and I'm telling them, you know, and I'm telling them what's going on, and that I am going to leave this relationship. And they said, be very careful. Have some numbers. Those people that you've met at your meetings that you go to, that I lied and said I was going to, because, you know, in outpatient treatment, you need to go to meetings. But I was a forger, so that was real easy on those little sheets. You know, I'd steal your identity real quick. I had forged. That's how I kept my addiction going. So I didn't have any numbers. So when I left, the only numbers I had were people who used. And I called them, and I ended up using. I'm not going to say I relapsed because I was doing no recovery. I was going to an outpatient program, but I truly wasn't doing any recovery other than the fact that I was recovering from a codependent relationship. That's where my recovery started, was recovering from a codependent relationship. When I was done with outpatient, I went in, and it was Monday, and my name wasn't on the board to pee. Woo! I could get away with it. Because I didn't go. Wednesday night was family night. They didn't pee test anybody on Wednesday. Thursday, by that time, what I used will be out of my system. And I sat there and I sat there and I sat there. But something had sunk in through these listening to them telling us to go to NA and giving us some ideas of what recovery was really about sunk into me, and I raised my hands and I said, I used. I told myself. For the first time in my life, I was honest. I told myself. I used. So they pulled me out for some little one-on-one counseling, and they kept me in another 2 weeks in the outpatient program, and I graduated. They said, you have an idea of what to do, you've got a grasp, but now are you going to take the steps? So I started going to some NA meetings, and I remember being afraid of walking into this place alone, and I came in with a hoodie on, and I waited for somebody who was in the rooms, who was in my outpatient, who knew these meetings, and I walked in with him. And I still, he's not clean today, but I thank him all the time whenever I see him. And sometimes when I just think of him and I say, thank you, Greg, for bringing me to the rooms with Narcotics Anonymous. I went in and I walked up to some people and I went to shake their hand and, you know, y'all grab me and hug me. I didn't know what this was, you know, it was men and I got big boobs. So that's all I thought they wanted was to build the big boobs, you know. So I'm still married at this point in time, you know, like I'm still married. I left the kids at home because where I went to live, the house that I got income tax. And rather than getting high with it, I went to somebody, and they knew how to buy houses from a one-on-one person. So, give you this, you hold my mortgage, land contract. So this is what I did. The thing with the house is it had no plumbing. Because in my neck of the woods, if you leave a house empty for 3 weeks, all the plumbing's gone. Because copper does real good for addicts. So they've taken all the copper out. So I can flush the toilet, but I can't run water to fill the toilet back up. So I'm living with a bucket, you know, that I'm pouring in to flush the toilet. I'm heating a little bit of water up in a microwave to wash my face and brush my teeth in the morning. I'm going to friends and family house to shower. I'm living in a dining room because the heat in this place is hot water. I have no water, so there's no heat. So there's French doors to the dining room and a butler's door to the kitchen. So I can keep everything in here, and I can live on a space heater, a boom box, a microwave, and a futon mattress. I'm good, but my kids aren't. So my kids are still at their dad's house. So I get up every morning, and I go, then my kids get off to school. When they come home from school, I come down there, and I cook dinner. I eat dinner, I do their homework, and then I leave. I go to a meeting, and then I go home. And I continue this routine, you know, and I'm done with the relationship. I know it's over. You know, we just, both of us at this time, I bankrupted the whole family, so neither one of us could afford the divorce, but we're done. I keep coming to the meetings and blah, 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 blah. I've got 89 days clean, and I found out I'm dating somebody in the rooms. You know, like, I'm like, what? Because here, you know, you go out with a group after coffee, you know, after the meeting, you go out as a group for coffee, and then you go home. And I always ended up taking this person home because they lived real close to me. Well, somebody says, how's it feel to be dating such and such? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they're like, you didn't know that you guys were dating? And I'm like, no. And then, oh, God, I'm dating now for the first time in 22 years. What am I going to do? So I got to look real cute next time I go out. So, needless to say, last year he became my husband. So, the first, I understand why they suggest that the men stick with the men and the women stick with the women. And I also understand why they suggest that you should not get into a relationship the first year of your, you should not make any major decisions. And a relationship is a major decision, but I understand why they, you should not make any major decisions the first year of your recovery. Because I was crazy. I was out of my mind. I drove my sponsor crazy. I drove my weed crazy. I drove everybody up and down the streets of McKeesport crazy. If you would pick up the phone, I was going to drive you crazy over this. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I was going to call you. Do you know what he's doing? Do you know this? I was going to drive you crazy. I was 42 years old. I had never been in a fight in my life. I put a baseball bat in the back of my car. Because, see, he was a trick and a hoe. That's part of his story. And he's not, he'll tell you. If she had more money, if she was going to buy the tennis shoes and the clothes for him, that's who he was going to sleep with for the night. But that's his story. And he said it to me, but I just didn't hear it. I heard what I wanted to hear, that he wanted to be with me. Didn't hear the other part of the story, that he was real honest. He was real honest about it. Because, see, he had a couple more years clean more than me. And he was real honest about it. He wasn't working on any recovery. He was just having some clean time. But here's me. I say, I have this baseball bat because she's buying them tennis shoes. And he says some things, yada, 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 yada. I leave the house because I got a key to be in his apartment. I go to her place. I bring her back to his place. Walk in and confront the whole situation. Now, meanwhile, I told you I was beat down for 20 years. Okay, so I got a lot of anger. I knew how to take a punch. I knew how to duck a punch. I had no idea how to throw a punch. I found out real quick. I got angry enough. And let's just say there's a washer here and a dryer here, and there's this little crack in between. She was down on the ground in the crack in between, and I'm on top of her pounding. And all this hatred and all this anger and everything that I've never released is coming out on her. Because he did me wrong. Because, see, he was my boyfriend. She didn't cheat on me. He did. Aha! But he had what I wanted. She didn't. So it was real easy to take the anger out on her. So, after talking to my sponsor and talking to some other women who loved and cared about me, couldn't wait for my 8th step to make an apology to her. I was only on step 3. But I owed her a sincere apology, and it was suggested that I do it at that moment. Because, see, God was doing some things in me that I knew it wasn't right what I did to her. So I apologized to her. I made an amends. I never confronted her about anything ever again. And I also made him a promise. Let me get that idea again. And I'll gently wake you up. I'll take that number and 9 cast iron skillet out from underneath your sink, and I'll knock you back out. And everything that I ever bought you will be tossed out that window and broken, cut up, destroyed, and I'll be gone. And we sat that day and we prayed together. And let me just tell you the power of prayer. Some changes began to happen. I'm not saying that was the last time he did what he did. I'm not gonna give him that much credit. I'm just being honest. But at that point, some things started to change. And it wasn't God quit making him cheat on me. It was God, if you want us to be together, do in me and do in him what you need to be so that we can be and live for you. And some things changed. Now back to the men with the men and the women with the women. I believe in that for most people. My husband has a female sponsor. He has sisters in this fellowship, in this thing here. And I had to come to grips with that. Why are you always hanging out with the chicks? Don't you know what you do? I had to come to grips with that. And when I developed some relationship with some men around here who helped me grow, like I have a big brother today, that when I cannot figure out how, because Like, I really like how Patty said about, like, I can accept some things about me, and I can accept that God is working on me, and there's some control issues I have, and that I have no power other than outside of me. I have a real hard time accepting that I don't have any power over him. I have a real hard time with that. When you don't make some sound financial decisions on our behalf, you know, those, she's saying this, and I'm sitting there going, like, thank you, God, for her story, because it lets me know that I'm not alone. Like, I'm okay with living in with my means. He's not. But we are one now. It's not just me. It's us. You know, but I have a man in my life who's like a big brother to me. And, you know, and when I have an issue, I can go to him. And I'm thankful for that, that this program gave me a brother. He wants nothing from me other than to see me grow. He wants nothing from me other than to be an ear for me, or me to be an ear for him. And I'm so grateful for that today. Because, see, I was raised as an only child. My grandparents raised me. See, I thought I was a throwaway child because my mother gave me to my grandparents to raise it too. When I got into this program and I started doing some work on me, I still thought I was a disposable person. You know, I was thrown away at the age of 2. Who does that? Come to find out that my mother treated me as a gift. I spoke with another recovering addict, and she was like, I don't feel guilty. They had about 3 years clean, 3-4 years clean. She was like, I don't feel guilty for giving my child to my parents to raise. Why don't I feel guilty? I'm a mother. I should feel guilty. And I said, no, you gave your parents the greatest gift of another child to raise in love. And you gave your child the greatest gift of 2 loving parents when you were unable to do that for him. And boom, that light bulb went out on. My mother gave me as a gift to my grandparents when she was incapable because she suffered from the same disease that I had but never knew how to handle. I was a gift. And I began to look at myself a little bit differently in the mirror from that moment on. I was a gift that was given to my grandparents. And I was spoiled on. I was given, my grandmother was a saleswoman and she loved to dress. And when I, and now you figure, this was in 1968. My mom was divorced, raising a child on her own. 1968, that stuff, divorce didn't happen in the 60s. You know, in the 70s it started, you know. So I was raised by my grandparents before it became fashionable to be raised by your grandparents. Because not one other child in my school was raised by their grandparents. And I was embarrassed. And I was ashamed. And so I was quiet in school. I was the fat chick in school. I was always the fat girl in school. You know, I was made fun of. I was teased. My grandparents' style was not the same style that was... If my mom was, my mother, you know, if my mom was raising me, because my grandparents' style was different. But as I got older, my grandmother's style became kind of my style, because she had to have, because of her job, you know, like, here I am, I want to dress nice too, and she truly believed in fashion. So fashion to her as being a saleswoman was, you know, your hat match and going to church, your hat match, your shoes match, your purse match, and gloves. She wore gloves, I didn't. Okay, but if I could get a hat, you know, like a summer hat, if I had a white one, a blue one, a pink one, a red one, a yellow one, I had all the color hats, and I had flat shoes, and I had shoes with heels on them, and I had a purse to match each one of those shoes. You know, there's a whole bunch of colors out there that you can find in purses and shoes. So I had a whole bunch of that stuff racked up in my room, but it never made me feel any better about myself than I already, because I always had that in the back of my mind that I was a throwaway child. You know, and this program, when that light bulb went on, I began to see, like, I was a gift. You know, and so what was this gift? What is this gift? You know, like, a gift is supposed to be something special. So what's special about me? And I found that there's nothing special about me. I am nothing without this program. I am nothing without the God of my understanding who leads me and guides me. I am a simple soul who's just being used by the God that loves me and showed me how to love you. You know, this year has been extremely difficult for me. Like, my first 18 months was hard. Because, like, remember I said, I was in that relationship and he was doing all this. And I believed on everything that my ex-husband did to me. I would lay my life down to believe that he was faithful to me. And because I was not one that you were going to cheat on and I was going to stay. You might beat me. You might break my arm. You might put stitches in me. You might call me a bitch and call me stupid and tell me I was worthless on a daily basis, but I was not going to stick around for you to cheat on me. April 12th of this year, I found out that my ex-husband and my best friend were having an affair my whole marriage, and that two, if not three, of my godchildren are my stepchildren. Talk about a gut shot. And that had some power over me. I felt so worthless. I felt so like I shared it with my sponsor. I shared it with my sponsees. I shared it with some people close to me, my we. And I was caught up. I was like, they saw me at work, and I work in a hospital now. And my doctor walked on the floor and he looked at me and he said, "What is going on with you?" And he pulled me to the side and I told him. And he was like, "We're going to get you through this. I'm going to give you a little bit. A week's worth of Xanax to get you through this and get you into some counseling and see where this goes." Out of that week's worth of Xanax, I have 5 days of it left. But for the, you know, like the first one, like I was bat crazy. I was absolutely out of my mind. I know in this program it tells me to make the right decisions. But every time I drove down the street, my ex-husband and I lived 3 blocks away from each other. Every time I saw it, when there's this really long hill, it's like from there all the way up to the other place over there, the dining hall. It's about that long, but it's a big steep hill. And every time I'm going, and there's two of them. You may go down one, and then you make a right, and you go down. And there are two of the main thoroughfares in the town that I live in. And every time, ever failed. Every time I'm going up the hill or coming down the hill, he's coming the other way. And I wanted to make a left-hand turn into his car so many times. I wanted to take him out, because here's my thing. You're in a little car, I got a truck. My insurance is better than your insurance because I know you don't know how to pay bills. Huh? So here I am. I'm driving down the road, and there's so many times I just wanted to turn left. And all I kept hearing was stay right. Stay right. Stay right. And some more things go on. This is all through from April 12th to May 4th. I find that information out. My dog has a litter of puppies, and out of 10 puppies, 9 puppies survive. So on a 3 or 4 hour basis, I'm going down to my basement and finding another dead puppy. And I have to go out in my backyard and I have to bury. And then I wake up in the morning and there's 3. And I have to go out and I have to bury 3. So there's this. There's this mourning. There's this death that's going on around me. And then the job I really wanted, that I had applied for, I don't get. God, what are you telling me? Like, really, how many gut shots can I take? May 4th, my mother has an aneurysm that bursts. I'm working in the hospital and I work on a floor that's orthosurgical. And everything happened, you know, like every night around 10 o'clock, because I get off at 11:15, I check the board, what's going on in the ER, because if there's broken bones, if there's hip falls, if there's anything like that, if we got, you know, appendix, anything going on where somebody's going to have surgery, my floor has to be prepped for it. So I got to get a room ready, I got to get the paperwork ready, blah, 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 blah. I go on there and I look and I'm like, there's nothing. Oh, wait, I know that name. That's my mother's name. Altered mental status. Hold on, my mom's in the ER, I'm going down. Down 7 flights, I'm down there. I go in, her boyfriend and my uncle are there, and we go, and we're talking, and I said, okay, I got to go back up to the floor. So I run back up to the floor. They're taking her for some tests. I run back up to the floor. I said, my mom is in the ER. They're like, call the supervisor, tell the nursing supervisor, you're done. Then I go downstairs. They take her. I send my uncle home. I send her boyfriend home. I curl up in a chair, and I said, I got this. I'm by her side. What I forgot to mention is that, remember my mom, I considered a throwaway. I considered myself a throwaway. So when I got old enough to say, no, I don't want you in my life, I said, no, I don't want you in my life. From the time I was 21 years old, until I was 44 years old. I didn't speak to my mother. When I had that revelation with my friend that I was no longer a throwaway child, I was truly a gift, it's when I called my mother for the first time in 24 years. My mom entered my life 6 years ago. Sorry, 5 years ago. We did some mending of our relationship. We sat down, we cried, we apologized, we made changes. We started to build a mother-daughter relationship. My mom was in my wedding, May 23rd, 2015. After that, she decided to move back up here from Florida. She'd moved out of state. You know, I didn't care where she went, you know, when I was 20. I didn't care where she went. I found out she'd gone to Vegas and she moved to Florida. I didn't care. She was not part of my life. She gave me away. She gave me up. She lost. My father was never part of my life. So, she has this aneurysm. So, they take her for a CT scan. Doctor comes back and he said, there's bleeding on the brain. We're taking her to Presby. I looked at him and I said, Dr. Andy, she can't die. I just got her back. You got to do whatever you got to do. I just got her back. See, what I forgot to tell y'all is I made a phone call to my mom when all this went on with my ex-husband to find out that that there were some innocent victims in a relationship that they had no, the children and myself. My children, her children, and myself were innocent victims in that whole triad of whatever you want to call my first marriage. When all that happened, I called my mother and I'm telling her and I'm rambling on and she said, baby, just stop. I said, what, mom? What? She said, at least it wasn't your sister. Because see, I grew up when I was 18, I found out that my cousin was my brother. Mm. See, my mother's sister cheated with my father. Well, yeah, tell me, I'm better than Peyton Place, ain't I? My mother's sister cheated with my father. So my cousin is also my brother. That is why my mom could not handle a whole bunch of stuff going on. That's why she divorced my father. It didn't matter to me. It didn't matter to me. I was thrown away. So when she said that to me, I was like, wow. You're right, she's not my sister. Even though I treated her like a sister and I gave her a home to live in, that wasn't my sister who did this to me. It was him. And it was a dog. Let him go. So, you know, she gave me some things. Some men in this program, when I told them, like, I was just like, they said, you don't live there anymore. Let it go. But then, like I said, it didn't mean that when I was driving down the road. I didn't want to turn left a whole bunch of time. I even had it planned. He bought a house at auction. Because I watch, you know, I still like real estate. You know, I'm thinking, well, maybe I'll get back into it. What a lie. I'll never pay that again. So I'm watching all the real estate sales. He buys a house down the street for me. And so I've already planned at this point in time because he bought the house. And then I find out he cheated on me. I've got my girlfriend's high-powered BB rifle. And I'm going to lay in the cemetery and I'm going to shoot out every window. Because remember, I told you he's not one big one on insurance. So I know if I shoot out every window in the house, he's out of luck. Because it's going to cost more to put windows in that house than it was and he paid for it in auction. Let's just say I gave the rifle back. And I've never turned left on him yet. I did cut up every photo album and pour it on top of his car. All our wedding photos, you know, and this was the real cute part. I've cut it all up. And it was very therapeutic, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm cutting up every picture of him and I. Cutting them up. Taking them, and he lives in the senior citizens building. No, he's not that old. But he lives, you know, like there's a population, they can only have so many, so he's disabled. I pour all the pictures on top of the car and his truck. See, he's got 2 vehicles, so I'm pouring them all over. And you watch these little old ladies who are sitting under the pavilion at the picnic benches, and they go like this, and they're like... And you get the one who's like the bold one out of the whole crew, and she starts going... So if I was laughing hysterically, and I'm taking pictures because you can't tell me that I vandalized. I may have littered. I know I littered. Not may. I did litter. But I didn't vandalize your vehicle, so you can't do anything. So I take pictures of everything that I do so that I can cover myself. So Back to my mom. So my mom is rushed to Presby. I don't leave the hospital. I just got her back in my life. We do mother and daughter things. We go shopping. We do this. We do that. We do whatever. We have dinner. You know, I got to celebrate Thanksgiving with her. I got to celebrate Christmas with her. I got to celebrate Easter with her. I got to have Mother's Day with her. No, I didn't. She was in the hospital. Anyway, the year before I got Mother's Day with her, before my wedding. So, my sister comes up from Florida. I call her and I tell her this, and she flies up from Florida. She tells me, "You got to go home." I'm like, "No, I don't." She's like, "Yes, you do. You have got to go home." And finally, I think on the third day, she said, "You stink. Will you go home?" You know, so I went home, and her and I begin to take turns, and she's here for a week, so I let her take the rest of the week, and then, you know, going down there. And see, I work an 11 to 11 shift, or a 3 to 11 shift, or a 7 to 7 shift. I work some crazy flipping hours in the hospital. But it was real cool because I'd go down Oakland at 11:15, 11:30 at night. Parking's free if you can find a spot on the street. So I park in Oakland for free. You know, and I go in, and my mom's in a coma. And right down the middle. She's bald. Because she's got a stent in her brain to drain the fluid. And so then she starts to sit up. She starts to talk, mumble. And I'm calling my sister on the phone, and I'm like, "Mom, sitting up." And I'm, you know, like this phone's on speaker, and you can hear her say, "I love you," and all this, you know. And I was like, "Yes." So we're doing this, and then she gets a little turn for the worse, some pneumonia. But this is to be inspected, it's a severe brain injury that she's had, because they've gone in there and they've cauterized the one aneurysm and blah, blah, blah. So she goes backwards. It's okay. We're going to take 10 steps forward, 5 steps back, 2 steps forward, 8 steps back. We know this is what our journey is going to be. So we're doing this journey. We're back and forth. We're back and forth. We're back and forth. She's up. She's walking with assistance. She's talking. The trach is no longer in her throat. She's breathing on her own. Things are getting good. You know, I would go in and I would say, "You like my husband?" "Yes, Aunt Jim." Like, "No, Mom, I'm not married to Jim anymore. His name's Curtis." "Oh, he's a doll. I like him." So, we're going back, but the next day I say, "You like my husband?" "No, I can't stand that MF-er." And I have to remind her, you know, we go over the grandkids' names and the great-grandkids' names. And when am I bringing her baby doll, which is my granddaughter, for her to hold? She's 3 years old, but she just thinks she's a baby doll. You know, so we're going through this, everything is going to have to be retaught and refought. At this point, she can't eat. Because she's got a feeding tube, because the trach and everything, she's just not ready for it. So everything is going to have to be retaught and rethought that she's doing so well. And we take her to a rehab facility. She's out of the hospital, and she's out of their step-down unit, and she's been there for a month. And so this is now the beginning of July, and she's there, and July comes and we move her, and it's Wednesday, and I take an FMLA day at work because, like, I'm the one here, so I'm in charge, I'm making decisions, and my sister and I were on the same page. So I take her there to the thing, and I sit with her, and she's like, "I'm tired now, you can go." So she falls asleep, and I go, and I tell them, you know, "You gotta move her up closer, she can fall risk." And so they're planning on moving her, and, you know, they get her room moved. They call me that night, and we move your room. Okay, that's Wednesday. Friday night, Saturday morning at 4:30 a.m. I get a phone call, and there's respiratory issues. We're going to take your mom to the hospital. Okay, I'm moving slow because I know how long it's going to take for them to get her in an ambulance, get her there, assess her, and blah, blah, blah. Remember, I work in a hospital, so I'm paying for it. So I go through this, and I'm getting dressed slowly but surely, and I get another phone call. She's going to Shadyside. No, she's got to go to Presby. So we're fighting back and forth, and then they call me back. "Yeah, we're going to take her to Presby. That's where she's been." Great. Okay, so then they get her to Presby. Okay, she's arrived. Wonderful. You call me and tell me she's arrived. That's surprising. Then I get the next phone call, the neuros. They're going to do these tests. Okay, by this time I'm dressed. Then the neurosurgeon calls me back and says, there's two bleeds. One's on her left side, it's very large, but it can be handled. There's one in her brain stem that's unrecoverable. this time I begin to weep. It's about 6:30. Unrecoverable. I know what that means. I know what that means. So I said, I don't care what you do, what machine she has to be put on. Because we made the decision my mom would not be live on the machine. My sister and I had made that decision. But I told her this time, I don't care what you do, what machine you use, she will be alive until my sister gets here. So you do it. But now I got to call my sister in Florida. Because I texted her and said, Mom's going back to the hospital. We're okay. And I go into the bathroom and I just totally lose it. And I get back up and I go to my husband and I say to him, because if he hears me cry on the edge of the bed with the doctors, he rubs my back. He don't touch, he don't feel, he's not wishing. But he knows at this point that I need some affection and I need some attention and I need some cuddle. I need some comfort. And I go over to him and I hug him as I'm ready to leave. And I said, do you think that if I stay here, that she just won't leave me? Because I don't want her to leave me now. I just got her back. I don't want her to leave me. And then I said, oops, I'm not God. So whether I stay or go, she's going. My choice is to be with her or not. I get in the car. And this song comes on the radio. And it tells me, you may be good, but I just don't feel good right now. But thy will be done. And that song carried me through the time that I had to sit and wait. And I sat there and I stayed with my mother. See, my sister lived in Florida. Was she going to fly? Was she, you know, I called my sister and I said, pull over. Because she tells me she's driving, and I'm like, pull over. She's like, why? I'm like, pull over. She's like, tell me. And I said, if you don't tell me that this car is in park, I'm not telling you anything. So I tell her, she's not going to make it. You need to come home right now. Ends up the flight's going to be $800 because it's a flipping weekend. So she drives home. And I'm like, pull over somewhere and stop in Virginia. You know, halfway from Clearwater here, pull over. She don't want to listen to me. She's going to drive. So she survived on gummy bears and Starbucks coffee until West Virginia, at which time it made her so sick she had to go over and puke. You know, and I'm like, see, I told you to sleep somewhere else. But she slept in West Virginia, and she came, and she got here, and we called all the family that wanted to come, and we said goodbye. And, of course, in my mother's own graceful style, the doctors, I mean, I was so bad Saturday night, because my sister didn't get here until Sunday. It was so bad Saturday night trying to get her respiration under control that we did not think she was going to make it. Trying to find the right medication mix to get her respiration under control, even on a machine, even on the ventilator. We didn't think she was going to make it. So Sunday, when we decide to say goodbye, and they clean her off the medication and they take her off the ventilator, and they said it won't be very long until she's gone because there was so much, so many issues. Ah, Puri Lane style. She wanted to hang on in here now and make us sit there and stare at her. Like, really? This is so my mother's style. So everybody else, my uncles and everything, it was just me and my sister and my niece. And one by one, you know, like, my sister and my niece go in the room and where there's recliners, and I sit there and I wait. And I'm watching her vital signs. And when I think things get bad, I go wake up my sister and I bring her back. And her vital signs improve. So then I can't take it anymore because I've been sleeping in a chair for 48 hours. And I go. And I fall asleep with my niece. And then my sister comes in. All three of us are asleep in the reclining room. And then they come in and they get us. And we walk in and my sister and I walk in. And meanwhile to say, my sister's 4 years younger than me. So at 20, when I said, Mom, I also said my sister, who was 16, because she was Mom's right hand. So my sister and I didn't have a relationship either. My sister and I now talk on a regular. We walked in. She grabbed Mom's left hand. I grabbed Mom's right hand. I think it was almost simultaneous that we grabbed her hand. The minute we grabbed her hand, she grabbed it. God put me in a position where I was prepared as much as I could
be to lose my mother. That I was at peace with the decision that had to be made, that we weren't going to put this wild child, this flop, this, my mom was such a hippie. Like, you know, like, she should have been in Woodstock and stayed there. You know, that was my mother. She just, you know, like, she would not want to live on a machine. We would not want to live, have her live on a machine. But if it wasn't for this program, I wouldn't have known, and I would have been selfish, and I would have kept her on a machine. You know, and when she passed, I had some people around here who came to my side. Who, like, I call, I have a friend, I'm like, how did you do it? How did you lose your mom? How did you go on? I had some people who had lost their mother before me in this program that I got to watch how they walked with their heads held high when their heart was in their stomach and lower and not used. There's a woman who I rode up here with today who I watched her when her mom was dying and when her mom left, that never lost a smile on her face because she had some joy in her heart. See, happiness depends on what happens around me. Joy will never leave me because it depends on the relationship that I have with the God of my understanding. And as long as I keep that relationship healthy, and as long as I keep that relationship at the beginning, then He will take care of me to never let me lose Him. Because as Patty said, He never left me. I always walked away from Him. But this program has given me the ability to keep that relationship, to keep that love, to keep that light within me alive. Thanks be to Allah for sharing.